For those who aren't already aware, Greg's a founding director of Taylor Fry Consulting Actuaries. He's an honorary professor at the University of Melbourne and University of New South Wales. He's going to talk to us today about credibility pricing, and in that area he introduced the concept of hierarchical credibility to actuarial literature, as he has many other topics. So to talk about computation of credibility coefficients for pricing, please welcome Greg.
Good morning, everyone. Yes, as the title tells you, I'm going to speak about computation of credibility coefficients. And I'll give some examples to show that this fits into a pricing framework. So here's the agenda. First of all, a statement of what is the problem that we're trying to solve here. Second, to talk about some of the fundamentals of credibility theory, because if we're going to be talking about how to estimate credibility coefficients, we need to have a framework within which to work. And then I'll go on to talk about how one can estimate credibility coefficients in some simple models. That will lead us into talking about analysis of variance. And then at the end, I'll just show very briefly how this might be extended to much more general models. I'll just point out at the start, this material is taken from a paper which is currently in press, but if you really can't wait to read it, you can find it on the University of Melbourne website. So here's the problem. We set it up this way. Suppose that you want to estimate some parameter to do with pricing. So it might be claim frequency as an example, but there are many other examples you could choose. Now, you have a measurement of this parameter available to you from the data, but your data may be very limited and therefore subject to rather large sampling error. You may have some prior information on the same parameter, which could be from industry data. So it could be from anywhere at all. It just represents your prior, that is, the value you would assign to that parameter if you had no data at all. And you wish to form an estimate of the parameter that takes these two pieces of information into account. So what weightings should you give to them respectively? That's the problem. Now, just a couple of examples to show that why should we care about this? Does it actually fit into insurance pricing in some way? So here's the first example. This is a workers' compensation example. And this is a problem where you need to rate workers' compensation by occupational code. Now, if you're following the ANZIC occupational codes, which would often be the case, you'll be dealing with a tree structure of occupations which goes down to, I think, 5 levels. And so that means that if you look at the total number of occupational codes available to you, it's in the hundreds, if not thousands, and you can imagine that the data sets that you have for individual codes will be very small in many cases. So this is a classical case for using credibility formulas. So the setup is that you have a pool. So, for example, the pool might be Tasmania, the whole of Tasmania. And you want to, you have a premium rate for that pool, and you want to allocate that premium rate to the major occupational groupings that are denoted by A, B, C, etc. And having done that, and you would do that, well, you could do that using credibility, where the rate assigned to occupational group A is a weighted average of the pool rate and the total data that you have for occupational group A. And then having done that, you may want to allocate occupation group A rate to its subsets, occupation groups A1, A2, etc., and then to A11 and A111 and so on. Second example, so this is a motor example. So I'll try to show here there's some versatility to this technique. And this is, here I draw on a paper that was presented to the 2007 Aston Colloquium. The setup here is the usual one. So you see in the box on the right-hand side, I've written a description of a multiplicative model. This consists of only two factors for ease of representation here. So you have pricing factors A and B, and you have a factor alpha that prices factor A, and you have another factor beta that prices factor B, and you just multiply those together. So I mean, this is a fairly typical model, the multiplicative model used for a motor portfolio. But suppose that in some parts of your data you have very little information. For example, there may be no recorded claims for when the pricing factor A equals 2. And if you just fit a GLM to that, naturally enough, it's going to tell you that the relativity for frequency in when pricing factor A equals 2 is 0. That's the best estimate a GLM will produce. But that's not what you want to charge in practice. So how might you vary the GLM in that case to produce more reasonable results? And again, one possibility is to use credibility theory. And always, when you use credibility theory, what you're doing is you're taking some linear mixture of the results you get from your data with some prior. So now, let's talk a little bit about what credibility theory is and just how a credibility coefficient relates to the data that you have. Now, this is essentially an area of Bayesian statistics. So it's a statistical area. It's a technical area. But I'll do what I can to keep that under control. First of all, just think of sampling a population, just the very simple concept of drawing a sample from a population. So I've represented it here with a little diagram on the right-hand side, which is saying that the population from which you're sampling has a mean of mu, and that mean defines a distribution, which is denoted by F. You don't know these things. You don't know what mu is. You don't know what F is. But what you do is you draw a sample, a sample of N observations from that population, and they're denoted by X. And then an estimate of mu is obtained by by means of the sample mean x bar. Right, that's very much first year stuff. But the reason that I look at that situation is that I now want to extend it slightly to one that will be useful for us. So here we are here. It's the same situation except for one thing, and that is that the parameter mu that we're seeking to estimate is no longer just a fixed number. It's a fixed number. In the previous example, it's a fixed number out there somewhere. You don't know what it is. There's no way you can find out, but you can estimate it. In this model, it's not a fixed number. It's a random drawing from another distribution. So you imagine that if mu is, let's say mu is motor claim frequency, it's not a fixed number. Some superior being has made a random drawing from somewhere and said, this year the value of mu is this. And now that value of mu determines everything that happens in the sampling that we do. You can, if you like, relate this to the weather claims that we were hearing about in the first session. Here you have you can think of the weather claims as having an associated parameter, which each year is drawn by whoever it is up there that decides what our weather will be. So it's an example like that. Now that's just to give a bit of jargon. In that situation, mu is called a latent parameter, meaning it's kind of hidden from view. And we now have a Bayesian situation, of course, because the distribution P from which we're drawing our parameter mu functions as a prior. And so if we want to make an estimate of mu now, then what we do is we take the Bayesian posterior mean, the expected value of mu conditioned by our observations. Note, I've assigned a mean of m to our prior distribution. So the sequence is we now start with a prior distribution that has mean m. We make a random drawing from that distribution and we get a parameter mu, which if we over many drawings, will average out at m. Now, I've written down the mathematics here, but it's just for those who want to check all the details of what I'm saying. The mathematics is not saying anything other than when we calculate the Bayesian posterior mean, the expected value of mu given x, it can be represented by Bayes' theorem in the form written there, involving multiple integrals. And one of the reasons I've written down such a complex expression is simply to show that it is a complex expression, and if you want to try to evaluate this, you've got a lot of work ahead of you. And in such a situation, you may choose to adopt a simpler approximation to the posterior mean rather than calculate those multiple integrals. Because imagine, if you go back to my workers' compensation example, if you're going to devolve a premium rate down through a tree of occupational codes and you're going to end up with, let's say, 1,000 different premium rates, you don't want to be doing 1,000 calculations that look like this. And so if you're going to choose an approximation to the posterior mean, an obvious thing to think of is that you choose a linear function of your data. The way I've expressed that is as if it's something that's done because it's intuitively obvious. In some intuitive way, you expect that if all of your observations were doubled, it would be reasonable to double your estimate of the parameter you're seeking. But it's a bit more than that. There are some quite strong theoretical reasons as to why taking a linear estimate is a reasonable thing to do. In fact, it's an optimal thing to do in many circumstances. I won't go into those, but I'll just point out that it's more than just doing what seems a good idea at the time. Again, just a piece of jargon, if you do this, you're constructing what's called a linear Bayes estimator. That means that you're looking at a Bayesian posterior estimator and you're taking a linear approximation to it. How would you decide what is a reasonable approximation? Well, I've written a possibility there, and it's pretty much the universally accepted one. it's reasonable to choose your linear approximation, the thing I've denoted by L of x, in such a way that the mean squared difference between your approximation and the true parameter you're seeking, mu, is minimised. So that seems a reasonable thing to do. Now, I won't give the proof, but it does follow that if you adopt that as an optimality criterion, the mean square criterion, then the linear estimator that emerges takes the credibility form that's given there. You see, it's a weighted average of two things, M and X bar. So it's a weighted average of the prior mean, that is the value you would have assigned to the parameter if you had no data, and also of the data. In particular, it's the way the data actually enter into this formula is just in the form of the arithmetic mean. And the weight that's placed on the data is denoted here by Z, and that's referred to as the credibility of the sample mean. And furthermore, you can show in this same calculation that Z must have a particular form, which I've written down there. Now, I should go back because there's something I didn't point out. You'll see that I've added in my little diagram on the right hand side, I've added a couple of things that weren't there before. I've now assigned the prior distribution P, which previously had a mean of m, another parameter, a variance that's called tor squared, and our sampling distribution f has a variance sigma squared, which may depend on mu. And those quantities are needed in the expression of the credibility coefficient, which you see on the bottom left of the slide. The credibility coefficient emerges as a relatively simple quantity. It's 1 plus something to the minus 1, where the something is essentially the ratio of two variances. On the top of the ratio, you have the data variance, sigma squared, or sampling variance, and on the bottom, you have the prior variance. And you have an N in there too, which accounts for the sample size. So to use credibility, what's needed is always some version of what's written on the left-hand side of this slide, that you need to make an estimate of some ratio of data variance to prior variance. Credibility always reduces to that in some form. This is not a particularly hard thing to do. There are various credibility systems in operation, but the majority of them that I've seen are not actually correct. They don't follow this protocol. It would be better if they did, and it's not that hard to do it. Now, in order to do it, though, we need a bit more data than we've been talking about. The reason for that is that we need an estimate of the prior variance tor squared, and as long as we are focused on just a single drawing from the prior, we obviously have no information on the variance. So in order to implement any kind of estimation, we're going to need to consider various drawings from the prior, a number of drawings. So that's the purpose of this diagram. We now have to contemplate the situation in which we make J drawings from the prior. It's still the same prior, mean M variance tor squared, but now we just make J drawings from it instead of one. And naturally enough, these are random independent drawings, so we get different values of mu, and each of those values of mu generates a distribution from which we actually can draw a physical sample. So we now have J different distributions with different means, possibly different variances, and we draw an N sample from each of them. Okay, that just says what I said then. So in this situation, as before, we estimate any one of the unknown means mu by means of a credibility estimator, L of X. Z is defined exactly as before. Obviously, the difference now is that each of the functions L of X has a different sample mean, X bar J, to relate to the particular sample that it's considering. So everything's the same as before. We still need to estimate the variance ratio. So the only thing that's changed is that we now have more data with which to do this. So we can set up our data as indicated by the box there. We can think of the different drawings from the prior as risk classes, or in the example I gave earlier, risk class equals occupational group. So what you're doing now is that you're imagining that the frequency associated with any occupational group is a random drawing from the entire population of occupations, and then you're drawing a random sample from that particular occupational group. So the observations can be represented in that matrix form, where the vertical axis labels the risk classes or occupations, if you like, and horizontally you list the N members of the sample taken for any one occupation. And if you now look at the quantity that needs to be estimated, you can see that what you're estimating is the ratio of the variance within classes to the variance between classes. Okay, the sigma squared is the variance of your sampling distribution, so you can estimate that within any one class. And tau squared is the variance of your prior, so it's the variance of the different risk classes. So to simplify this, it's not necessary to do this, but it makes it simpler. I'll assume that each risk class has the same sampling variance sigma squared. And if you do that, you can now recognise that what you're doing with this array of data in looking at variance within classes and between classes is just an analysis of variance. And if you've forgotten what you've learned about analysis of variance, go back to any textbook, look it up, and you'll see that it looks exactly like the setup I've got here. And it is, it's the same thing. And when you carry out an analysis of variance, what you do is you set up a null hypothesis, which quite typically would be that all the risk classes are the same. You're testing whether there's any detectable difference between them. And you do that by means of an F statistic, which, so it happens, is the reciprocal of the ratio that we require here, the ratio of within class to between class variances. So this means that an estimated credibility coefficient reduces to quite a simple form, as shown on the bottom right there, where it involves simply the sample size and the F statistic from an analysis of variance. This is not a new thing. This has been known since 1977. It's also handy to recognise that any analysis of variance can be regarded as a regression. It doesn't work the other way. Not every regression can be regarded as an analysis of variance, but every analysis of variance can be thought of as a regression. And so I've rewritten the analysis of variance from the previous slide in regression form there. So here you just assume that each observation, X, consists of a mean mu plus random disturbance, epsilon. The random disturbances have mean zero and variance sigma squared. And you want to test the null hypothesis that all the mu's are the same. If they are the same, then the model collapses to the form shown there with just a mu in place of all the different, the mu1, mu2, etc. And you can test that as one regression model versus a simpler regression model, and you do that in the same way. It's an F statistic. The F statistic is the same as you get from an analysis of variance. This means that you can use regression software to carry out the evaluation of F for insertion in a credibility coefficient. Just a couple of examples to finish off, just looking at rather more general examples than the simpler ones I gave at the start. In this case, I still have the hierarchical framework, and so you can still think of it as representing the same setup as before. You can still think of it as being Tasmania, split into all its occupational groups, if you like. But the difference is that you'll notice in this diagram we're talking about parameter vectors, rather than just a parameter. So we're thinking in more than one dimension for the parametric space here. And so this means that if you look at level one in that tree, where the parameter vector beta j appears, beta j is a vector. It will consist of a number of components, and that vector is sampled from a prior whose mean is another vector called beta. And if you go to level two of the tree, you're looking at vectors, parameter vectors beta jk, which where each of those is sampled from a population with a mean beta j. So each, if you look at the bottom row of that diagram, you take if you take any of the boxes that have the same root immediately above, they all have the same prior mean. And so for this case, the procedure is essentially the same as before. In this case, because you're dealing with a parameter vector rather than just a scalar parameter, you're going to need to carry out a regression to do estimation, and you're going to get a regression estimate called beta hat. But beta hat, the credibility estimator, I mean, is beta hat, and that's a linear combination of the credibility estimator that you obtain at the next level up in the tree and the data that you have for the particular box that you're concerned with. And the credibility assigned to that particular formula takes the same form as before, involving the F statistic, where F is, as before, just the regression F statistic for testing one model against a simpler one. So that slide just says that. It's the same as before. You set up a null hypothesis, you conduct a regression analysis to test that hypothesis, you get an F statistic, and that's what you need for your credibility formula. A further example is one, again, the hierarchical model, again with parameter vectors requiring estimation, but here I've given a specific interpretation of those vectors. They represent time trends. So this is the example. If we go back to the one I've been using, the Tasmania with occupational groups, this now is Tasmania with occupational groups, where any node of the tree is subject to its own trend. So they're all trending over time, but they can trend differently. And then I've given the references to which I've referred as I've gone along. So that's the end. I can take questions if there are any.
There are a couple of questions. I knew you were smart, Greg, but you've actually just answered one of the questions with that slide, so you're even smarter than I thought. Okay. One quick question. The example you gave at the end there was talking about the... you expanded a little bit on the workers' comp example with the different occupation categories. How do you go about getting the prior means and variances for the motor example that you gave earlier in the presentation, which, I guess, doing a lot of work in motor, it's less obvious to me where you get those prior means and variances from?
Yep. Okay. Now, there are probably quite a few answers to this question. I suppose the most general answer is the one that applies to the abstract case, the just totally general case of using a prior. The question always arises in any Bayesian exercise: where does the prior come from? It comes from wherever you can get it. So in one of the statements I made at the start of this, I said that the prior might come from industry data, and you, in doing this analysis, you may be doing the analysis of a single company, and so you regard the industry data as representing the total universe, and so providing the prior. That's one possibility. But you descend from there to all kinds of other things, such as expert advice, intuition, prejudice, just anything at all that may usefully contribute to a prior view. Of course, in the worst case, you may consider that there is no such information. I mean, in other words, if you had no data and you were asked to quote a premium rate, your answer would have to be, I simply can't do it. I can't tell you anything whatsoever about the premium rate. But that's an unusual situation. Usually you know something. You have some kind of information. And remember that one of the stipulations here was not only that you have a prior mean, but you have a prior variance as well. So you may be in a situation where you have only vague information, but if you have that, then you're better to quantify it and assign it a large variance and then proceed than to ignore it. In specific cases, let me give you one of the applications of this, which will give an answer to this question in the particular context. This setup is used for the ACT government. The ACT government has its workers' compensation insured by the federal scheme, and the ACT government is just told by Comcare, you pay us a premium of, let's say, $30 million. Now, that's all they're told. But that's a fixed number. That's the pool premium. You can't change that. That's fixed. What they then need to do is to take that $30 million and cut it up into pieces that will be invoiced to the Department of Health, another one the Department of Education, and so on. And those, then the Department of Health will need to apportion their share to their various cost centres, and there may be sub-centres and so on. Now, in that example, the mean of the prior distribution is fixed. It's the $30 million. So there are applications where you're attempting to dissect a fixed quantity, and that becomes the prior mean.
Okay, I might just ask you one more, and I'll read this one word for word because I'm not an expert in this topic. There's a well-established class of statistical models called mixed effects models. Some of the parameters are regarded as fixed, while the others are assumed to be sampled from a certain distribution. The estimates of random effects are similar to credibility estimates, and the software for fitting such models is readily available. Is there any advantage of using the presented techniques instead of the mixed effects models?
Right, all of that's true, and in fact there was a paper 1 or 2 years ago, I think by Verrill and someone else, maybe Nelder and Verrill. Anyway, there was a paper that that showed the equivalence between credibility methods and random effects models. It's a reasonable suggestion to use that software. I haven't actually done that, so I I guess I'd probably need to think about whether you can fit all the cases, all the models that you'd want to look at within that framework, but it seems to me very likely that you could. And of course, what that will do is effectively carry out the F test for you and assign you coefficients. So yeah, that seems to be a pretty good suggestion.
Okay, I think we've probably used up the time. Thank you, Greg, for an interesting conversation. I actually felt like I could follow that presentation, even though there was lots of formulas and everything, so that was really good. So if everyone could thank Greg for an interesting presentation.